I'm at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, MESA Lab, speaking to Larry McDaniel, who's a researcher here. And thanks for the interview, Larry.
You bet. Glad to do it.
And what is it that you've been working on?
For several, almost two decades, I've been studying climate change, climate impacts on agriculture, and the possible impacts on future agriculture. And I study observed as well as model data, and do a lot of analysis of model output.
And what is it that you've been working on most recently?
I just developed a nationwide data set of 5,278, I think it was, 55-year stations. Daily data for, we hope to do heat wave studies, both rural and urban, and also look at the effects on human beings, and also to look at effects on agriculture, livestock in particular this time. And then that same data will be used for another part of our group that's doing studies with cities and health impacts, and we hope to come up with parameters for combining heat and ozone for asthma attacks and so on. That's in the development stages with a professor at the University of Michigan.
So So you've worked with models for a long time. You've worked with observed data, and you've worked with models for a long time. How have you seen? There's two parts to this question. How have you seen models themselves sort of change and evolve over time? And how have you noticed people's sort of the public's understanding of models to have changed over time?
Well, when I started working directly with the models, it was 87, and the resolution of the model was a grid box. They set them up so that they run, it looks like grid boxes, and then calculations are done for each of those locations at multiple levels in the atmosphere and the ocean, and then surface processes and so on. And in those days, the resolution was roughly the size of Kansas.
Wow.
And so it was very hard to be specific about an area, even a region, was pretty iffy in terms of making any conclusion.
But these layers of the model that you're talking about, those have not changed.
Really? Well, there's more of them now.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm.
And the resolution has increased. Another factor with the older models is that precipitation was done in what by modern standards is pretty primitive, and that when the moisture in the atmosphere got to a certain level, it just all dropped out. So you'd have these enormous rains that don't happen anywhere.
Interesting.
So that's why we had to study climate, because it's over time, and when you average over time, those things get smoothed out. And so now the resolution is as high as 50 kilometers.
Wow.
And so now we can look more closely at regional impacts and drainage areas for hydrology and
I've heard resolution down to like 3 kilometers.
Some
places.
You can take it down that far. The WRF model here is, I worked with some data that's 4 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking at snowfall in the Rockies. So you can go that far, but the general resolution stops at about 50 kilometers.
You know, I've heard kind of conflicting things from some of the atmospheric scientists that I've spoken to about on the one hand, some about models. On the one hand, some of the scientists have said, you know, it doesn't matter how good the resolution is. There's always going to be a certain amount of uncertainty. We're never going to be able to predict, you know, a week out or 2 weeks out, you know, more than that. But other scientists I've spoken to have said, you know, we just need better models. We just need higher resolution and faster computers and more input data. And, you know, we will have completely accurate prediction.
Well, weather, when you're talking a week out or something, you're talking about weather.
Yeah.
And that's inherently difficult. And if you're in the middle of Kansas, it's going to be easier than it will be at the foot of the Rockies.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, the question depends on where you are to a certain extent.
Interesting.
Higher resolution doesn't help unless the physics of the model improves along with that. Sometimes a higher resolution gives you better agreement with observed data, but it's not clear that the higher resolution did that for the reasons you'd like it to.
Uh-huh.
It can be an artifact of just the process. Hmm. So the physics has to improve. With higher resolution, we can look at least from my point of view, we can look at details that we can't look at now. Things like the drainage in the watershed for Boulder.
Right.
The grid boxes are of a size now that is pretty hard to make much, too many useful predictions. I mean, over time, again, when you're looking at climate,
yeah,
you can, because things get averaged. And that's one of the problems people have with understanding that we are so confident of climate change,
mm-hmm.
when they see we miss weather forecasts.
Exactly. Seems like climate is even longer term than weather.
Right.
What's the difference?
Because the climate is like a 30-year average.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those missed daily predictions are balanced out over time, and it becomes the longer time period gives you more certainty of what you're coming up with.
Well, this is what's a little bit confusing to me then, is that when you talk about climate and averages, you know, you may think, go back to like the Ice Age, and if you were going to take an average of, you know, 50 years at the end of the Ice Age and then 50 years after the end of the Ice Age, if there's even that kind of clear delineation, that average would be kind of all, it would not be correct, right? So how can we project into the future using these averages if, for example, we might be moving into a different kind of climatic?
When you say a 50-year average during the ice, into the Ice Age, and
yeah, so if you took a chunk of time, I don't know, 50 years or 1,000 years or something, you took a chunk of time that was partially during the Ice Age and partially not, or even Ice Age, and then you're averaging it. That's what is, I think, is a little confusing to me about climate averages they're projected into the future.
If you were interested in a representational climate for that time period, you wouldn't take it during one of those big changes.
Right.
That's what happened with the Colorado River when they divvied up the water rights in 1921 or somewhere in that range. They were if you look at the rainfall or the river flows, they were at a high on sort of a plateau at that point.
Okay.
And it was above the mean.
Yeah.
So now that we're operating below the long-term mean, there's less water to divvy up.
Uh-huh.
And that's where they didn't take a long enough time period to determine what the mean was.
I see. So then it seems like the you know, some of the arguments that people make about, you know, there's no climate change happening, or is, you know, my, are that, you know, there isn't a long enough record or something. I mean, how do you respond to something like that?
Well, the one of the ways that one of the things that gives me confidence is the mm-hmm. number of years we've had with the that have been in the top 10 in terms of temperature for 100 years.
Okay.
Every time you would expect that it'd be 1 in 100.
Right.
But if you get a handful of times in one decade, the probability of that happening by chance is like winning the lottery.
Right. Well, at the same time, the physics models of what would happen, you know, based on the composition of the atmosphere, which we know probably pretty confidently, are consistent. Is that what's
with,
happening?
Yeah, with those.
Uh-huh, with those kind of changes.
Right. That's that would be at least a qualitative means of validating the model result.
So you talked about the physics has to get better. Have you seen, has the physics gotten better since those 87 models?
Oh, yes. Yes. There's all the young people that have come along in between have, the way science works is they get their PhD, they have to find a niche. And so they look at the models and find, you know, their professors help them, of course, find things that don't work so well, or a function that has been used to describe this process, but he may think there's a better one. And so they, you know, suggest they study these things in graduate school, and then when they're out, they start publishing. And so these people have all raised the bar a lot. And along the way, new processes have been added to the model. In my time here, we've added sea ice, and
right.
land surface processes, plant type.
Plant type, even. Wow.
You know, because they have different albedos.
Yeah.
Reflects light differently. Mm-hmm. Different percent of the light's reflected. Oceans have made tremendous strides. They were deep. When I first started, they were like a 200-meter slab that was just this kind of black box.
Yeah.
And lots of things were happening there, but we couldn't resolve them. And now the oceans are much better than they have a higher resolution, and they can pick up circulation patterns.
Is that because there's buoys out there that are taking data and satellite data, or is it the physics, or?
Yeah, I think the El Nino process has spawned a lot of studies and financing for monitors, and that gives us raw data. And ships for years have collected data, and now we have satellites that we're learning to use, and they're really valuable.
And what in the models, in your opinion, is still missing, or what needs to be developed?
Well, having studied agriculture so much, rain is the prime driver of those agricultural models, and one of the things that the regional models that we use most of the time, that resolution at roughly 50 kilometers, the convective storms aren't well represented. They have to be parameterized, and they're, the numbers come from what you would expect in July or something. Of course, that's influenced by the larger circulation patterns, so it's not wrong. It's just that the rate of precipitation and the frequency are not what we see in the observed data.
Oh, okay.
So if they could, that's a physical aspect that they could improve on, and it's a very mm-hmm. difficult one because it's just two air masses moving across each other that creates the storm.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to...
That's a very monitor. Small detail.
Right. It happens on a small scale. And, some of the microphysicists here can put ice on an airplane.
Right.
But the resolution is down to in the millimeters. And in order to do that, because there are so many different states, not really states, but types, like types of ice or types of snow or crystals.
I know if I don't ask you to clarify this, I'm going to have to be emailing you about it later. So explain to me again, so we've got these scientists with ice on an airplane, and
well,
what is going on?
You were talking about resolution and convective storm.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused me to think that the resolution where they can actually approach some of these processes is so small that it's
uh-huh.
not, we can't realistically expect to be there in decades.
Right.
You know.
Observed or modeled, really, is what you're saying.
Well, they fly airplanes around and collect the data. I mean,
right.
They know what they can observe it, but the modeling is more, it's outside of my...
And when you talk about this ice in an airplane, are they actually collecting things from the clouds? That's what's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Is what you're saying similar to what I've heard more in the mainstream media about the clouds being the biggest kind of uncertain parameter when it comes to predicting climate change? I've heard some things that about that clouds may respond in certain ways to warming that we don't know about. Is that kind of what you're talking
well,
about?
Well, no. That's
okay,
a
that's different.
That's a large
issue.
Scale
yeah.
process. And that, to my knowledge, that's been pretty much worked out.
Oh, really?
They were concerned about the moisture in the atmosphere and how much impact that would have on the warming. And it's my understanding that's been worked out. But again, that's a process I'm not familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
The clouds I'm talking about are the ones that
yeah.
kind of line up along the Rockies in the summertime when the plains heat up. And as they heat up, the air moves uphill. And it comes to the mountains, and it goes vertical, and where it runs into cooler, moist air, and turbulence causes rain.
So just one more kind of, I think, technical question about models, since I have you here as an expert, something I always wondered about. So you've got a kind of flat plane resolution grid, and then you have these different layers. What about the vertical? What about the perpendicular from the Earth's surface? Is there a need or desire to increase that resolution, or has that been pretty stable?
Well, that's increased.
mm-hmm.
And it helps you to have wind, say, for smaller differences in elevation
yeah.
helps you determine circulation more clearly and other processes that just more details, and the equations can resolve.
Yeah, I mean, I know just coming up here to Mesa Lab that you get a different kind of climate.
Oh yeah.
And that's, you know, you could walk or ride your bike up here.
Yeah.
It's not that far.
Yeah, it's like an inversion in a
mm-hmm.
in a valley. There's you don't have to go far, and you can be above it.
Mm-hmm.
That's clear sky.
Okay, so on to maybe some more art and science related stuff. Now you have a very, I guess, unusual background for somebody who's at NCAR in that you've got an MFA.
Right.
How did you go from having an art degree to doing this climate research?
Well, this leads into something I'd like to talk about, actually.
Okay.
I went to CU to change my art. I was working as an artist in the 70s, and I needed change, and I was on my own. I wasn't, I needed criticism, I needed exposure to new ideas, and just the intellectual environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to CU, and my work changed to more of a political sense. I chose some topics I was interested in at the time and that would have controversy associated with them, and so I could get people, the viewer, involved in the work because of what they brought to the image. And how I got into science was that I had a part-time job while I was in grad school because of my statistics background, studying wheat disease and climate.
Hmm.
And then, because of that, I worked here just on any corner I could find, and I met some scientists, and they were interested in communicating with the public.
Just to clarify, wheat disease, from the plants for our agriculture.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Septoria tritici is the main one.
Mm.
It causes damage to the leaves of the plant, therefore reduces the yield. And we were looking at what was it in climate, or was there a time of year when they were more vulnerable, or when they were being impacted, and other times they weren't, and why were they being impacted at that time? So
you knew some things about statistics and computer programming at Alaska.
My bachelor's is in statistics.
Oh, okay.
And I learned to write code during that time.
So they found out you were an artist and decided to.
They were more interested in communicating to the public what they were learning, and so I made some animations of climate change, current globe, future globe, and then the model runs from each to show how the future heats up.
Mm.
And they were done very simply. The point was to make them simple so that people that aren't used to working at graphics could comprehend what was going on without, and still listen to the discussion that was going on. So that's how I got hired.
So this was back in the 80s?
87.
Wow. And so has the predictions of warming changed since then? Much?
Not much.
Really, yeah.
The physics, the global numbers have not changed much. We knew that it was going to warm in the higher latitudes more than lower. Big kind of coarse concepts came through even then.
So why was it that you wanted to then come and work here? Didn't you feel that was restricting your artwork? Or
of course.
Yeah, you did.
It was a decision I had to make.
Mm.
In part, it was the family decision.
Mm-hmm.
I had two children, and we liked it here.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to move. I was offered support and encouragement if I moved to New York or
right.
Philadelphia or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But the family wasn't, of course, interested. The kids were real young.
Yeah.
So it was, that part made it easy, but the artist part was a tough decision.
Did you feel that there were any kind of connections or links to what you were doing?
We talked about that
come
a lot
later?
With the scientists, you know, mm. Why, what's the difference between art and science? And one of the conclusions we came to was that scientists report and artists express, and that they were interested in being able to express what they were understanding rather than report, or you know, like a lecture where you know the students are coerced into comprehending what you're saying because they're going to have to take a test.
Right.
The public is not. And so it has to be a more sophisticated, on one hand, a sophisticated approach to understand how to communicate.
Right.
But also to simplify the science so that it can be comprehended. Many, if you look at science papers and the graphics in them, if you study them and think about it, you can figure out what it means. But if you just have a glance,
mm-hmm.
you probably won't.
Well, when you talk about expression versus reporting, doesn't that get into issues of a personal expression that seems to be kind of against what science is supposed to be? You know, kind of a more subjective point of view versus an objective point of view?
Well, the scientists are talking about their work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about their work.
Uh-huh.
The bigger body, the discussion like the IPCC level,
right.
that's objective, but it also goes through 3,000 scientists, I don't know how many thousand political types,
mm-hmm.
to end up with the IPCC. So how much of that is objective from where, you know, in comparison to where it started?
Right. Well, some of the IPCC scientists I've spoken to have been really adamant about, you know, being non-political and at least the same.
Oh, they
it's
are.
Difficult. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that message goes through those different layers, the political being the final step, speaks with quantities he can report from his experiments. And they're different things, and the process of research is a continuing process. The more we learn, the more questions we have. And so that things spread out and the question, more people are answering the questions, and then we get more precise and we criticize each other's work so that we can hone it in to something that is totally objective.
Right.
Or as close to totally objective as we can get.
Mm-hmm.
But the artist is, his tool is the metaphor, and if he can relate this information, whatever he or she's trying to convey, to the biggest audience, then that's what they're after. Now in the social sciences, it's a similar process in that. You're measuring health impacts of some number that has been quantified by someone else, but your health data is derived from populations where there's, say, I don't know, this is just making it up, but mm-hmm. say 5% of the public, if the temperatures are above 90 degrees and there's a lot of air pollution, they can have asthma attacks or something. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're going to have that.
Right.
But it's the group, there'll be some of those people that have it. So that's where the subjective statements are coming in, is that it's not necessarily about you, but
right.
it's about a population.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I noticed with some of the scientists that I followed in Antarctica, as they're collecting data, was that, you know, they would have a weather station and they'd collect a certain amount of data, but they would compare that data with what they're actually observing on the ground. So in a way, that's a kind of subjectivity that actually improves the science, because they can say, you know, well, the weather station was covered with snow or something, mm-hmm. and I saw that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten these strange readings or whatever, and
right.
I wouldn't have known what it means. And I guess if I'm understanding you correctly, you're taking this to the next level of saying the health of an individual can really be seen as a subjective.
Well, the information
response.
The information that comes to the public sounds subjective because it's not about an individual; it's about a population,
mm-hmm.
and it's a concept that you take cholesterol, for example. That the what they tell you about cholesterol is meant for a population,
right?
But if you don't have plaque in your arteries, then the cholesterol that you have is not causing you a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to take the cholesterol-lowering medicine because you don't have the problem.
So have you noticed in your work with food supplies and things like that, that the responses of reporters or of the general public, that they lack an understanding of what you're presenting, or there are aspects of what your research is that you think the public is not understanding as well as it could?
Yeah, I think, you know, the part of it is, you know, the media has limitations on what, I mean, their purposes in being there are not the same as we would like in terms of conveying information.
Mm-hmm.
And when things like medical research, you know, one day, you know, I hear this all the time, you know, caffeine's good for you, caffeine's
yeah.
bad for you, wine's bad for you, wine's good for
right.
you. And what that tells you is that there's research going on in those areas, and these are results of those research. And the final determination those differences probably mean that it varies amongst human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And for some it's good, and some it doesn't matter, and some it's bad.
Now, you've been part of a movement to bring more of the social sciences into the atmospheric research being done here. Can you tell me a little bit about what that group is and what you're doing?
The name of our group is the Institute for the Study of Society and the Environment. And we have economists, we have we do demographics, we do study cities, many aspects, health and growth and transportation. The economics has gone into the fisheries, the battle between the different fishing groups that was going on with Canada and Alaska
right.
and Northwest. was the conflicts were brought on by a diminishing supply, as well as changing patterns from year to year, depending on you know, their life, mm-hmm. the fish, life of the fish.
Right.
So people wanted to fish in areas where there weren't enough fish to help do it without damaging the population. So they went together and they made a treaty where they share the bounty, basically. And that's an aspect of the climate that we knew about here and studied here, and then one of the economists went to work with other disciplines to come up with what became a treaty for the fisheries.
So there are already scientists here that are collaborating with the social sciences.
Oh yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And but you were saying that it's a struggle, or that it's not maybe happening as quickly or as much as you would like.
Well, the public interest in climate has increased tremendously in the last mm-hmm. 5 years, and we've seen the demand for information and collaboration with, you know, cities and counties and regional impacts groups that they want information, they want help or whatever, and that's growing. The funding isn't a good time funding. It's kind of out of phase with the demand.
I see.
And so we're trying to build a program as best we can with less than optimal staff. But it's going to be the future holds well. I mean, it's going to be good, I think.
And really, in a way, having these social sciences as part of the research is not going to bring more uncertainty or subjectivity into it. It's actually going to make it more possible to evaluate everything that's going on.
Yeah, and it'll help the public understand what's going on. It's we're there to bring the information to the public so they can not only understand it, but use it in their decision making, so that you know, the decisions they make are going to be based on what realistic expectations of the climate in the region they're in.
So potentially, you know, NCAR could be running climate models that set up not only parameters of CO2 concentrations in the air, but parameters of legislation that's being enacted. For
yes, our people testified before Congress, and they last fall they worked on a bill that the staff, congressional staff, they came here to work with our people. They sent it out, and we some of our people reviewed it, and then they met and told them where deficiencies they thought were deficient and what was good and so on. Mm-hmm. We think that is a very important role.
When you first joined and you had been doing political artwork, did you ever think that you know, kind of the political climate, for lack of a better word, around climate would end up being so large?
No. When we first started and I was making those animations in the late 80s, the feeling was that if we could, at least this was my perception, mm-hmm. was that if we could convince enough of the Congress to educate them enough and convince them that if we took small steps, that would reduce our need to make big steps later on.
Mm-hmm.
And they related to like having insurance. You're not likely to have a car accident today, but you have car insurance.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cost you a great deal, but it could save you a big problem in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the argument. But because our certainty was lower than, they wanted more certainty. And it was kind of like they didn't want to make any change in our economy. They were afraid that would cause problems.
Right.
But
do you think that had to do with the, I guess it was 10 or 20 years before that there was some predictions about a global cooling and then it changed to global warming, that there was a sort of mistrust of?
I don't think many people knew about that.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Other than, some people that were on the fringes of science.
Right.
And that is my understanding of that. That was before me.
Mm-hmm.
But it had to do with cutting off what's called the conveyor belt, moving warm air north.
Mm-hmm.
So it melts ice and then that sinks and that causes a flow.
Right.
Along the coast of the continent. Well, that was suspected of weakening and resulting in a little ice age in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the idea that flow would be cut off. But in those days, things were much more primitive than they are now.
Yeah.
And we didn't have all the monitoring devices. We didn't have satellites. And the models were very simple. So that the public looks may, a critic may say, well, that's 180 degrees from what.
Yeah.
But it really was one of the processes in climate change that could happen.
And yeah.
We have less concern in the next 100 years about that now than we did a few years ago, but it was still in the realm of possibility.
So really what you saw in the hearings in the 80s was it was more about the government being concerned about taking an economic risk without...
Why do we need the change?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, it was maybe 50-50 or 60-40 at the time. I don't know, somewhere. I mean, no one ever put a number on it.
Right.
Was just something that was likely to happen,
mm-hmm.
and our models were saying that, and it all made sense in physics, in terms of physics. If you trap more energy in the system, then that energy has to go somewhere.
Right, right.
It'll either be heat or, the winds or whatever, but it's
mm-hmm.
it's going to be there. And carbon dioxide's life in the atmosphere is something like 200 years.
Yeah, yeah. So now, or after that, then the burden came onto the shoulders of the scientists to say, well, if the concern is on the economy, then maybe we need to bring economics into our models and. Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of work done to show that. Alternative energy actually makes more jobs than fossil fuels because you have manufacturing involved and transportation and so on. But it'll make jobs, and it'll make jobs locally. There's
mm-hmm.
great potential right here in this region. In fact, there's a factory just north of here to make wind turbines.
Wind.
And
solar, I imagine, too, is pretty
good. And solar. I don't know where that's manufactured, but there's some quite successful companies here in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
It faded. I mean, there was a time when people like me were crawling around the roof putting passive solar panels up.
Yep.
And then that kind of faded.
Mm-hmm.
But now economics are such that it's quite feasible. Somewhere around $10,000 for a single-family home will pretty much cover your electrical need.
And with the cost of oil, it's kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and gas, price of gas. Mm-hmm. Primarily, it's gas here, and it's increasing, and it can't last forever. There's just it's based on the biomass that was sequestered, and there's a limit to how much biomass there was.
Right. Well, just one last thing that might be kind of off the wall question, but I wonder if you have any thoughts about it, because some of the other people I've talked to have talked about it. These geoengineering projects that people are talking about, is that something that you guys run in the models about? And
they've done experiments with that, and it works. You know, like throwing iron in the ocean.
Yeah.
But it also changes the chemistry of the ocean, and that's the problem with food source. I mean, if you're just looking at human beings, it's a problem for food and ultimately life in the ocean. It depends on the quantity. Now, if you blast sulfur into the atmosphere and it reflects more, that life expectancy is it's hard. I'm not sure about this, but I think it's like a couple of years, three or four maybe, and then you'd have to do it again. And with the geoengineering, it's so who decides what to do and how much to do? The one with the biggest arsenal?
Right.
That may not be best for everybody. It's best to stop doing things that aren't sustainable.
So there's a there's enough knowledge now with the models to have a pretty good sense or a very good sense of what a geoengineering project is going to do, and it's what's known is that it's going to affect some groups positively and some groups negatively, and that's
that's
a concern.
It's hard to say what the impacts would be. I mean, we didn't realize at some point that burning fossil fuels is going to have an impact. And there's all these unexpected things that we didn't, even when we started to understand that it was going to cause a problem, there's lots of things that happen that you didn't expect. And that's what I would expect to happen with anything that man tries to do. There's going to be consequences that they didn't expect.
Right, even removing CO2 from the atmosphere, as some proposals are.
Yeah, I just read about that recently. I don't know a great deal about that. I know it would take energy, and there was proposals to use solar or wind or nuclear to do that. But I have zero understanding of what kind of quantities we're talking about, and how much, what level of activity would be required to make an impact. But anything would be better than having sea level go up 3 feet.
Yeah. So that's all I had. Is there something else that you wanted to talk about in more detail?
Well, I think we've kind of hit everything. I think the weather and climate issue, what we observe as weather causes the public to think that the ideas about climate are not on the mark, when you're comparing apples and oranges, basically. And I think the public, as well as scientists, need to understand better that the media is not there to necessarily bring you objective information. They're there to sell cars and whatever. So they need, you need lots of sources of information. And just casual reading of information that's outside of your comfort zone is, in time, becomes useful.
Great. Thank you very much.